This is Leslie Scheel speaking with Steve Scafidi about his book, Sparks from a 9-Pound Hammer. Last night, September 27th, Steve gave the 5th annual Larry Levis reading. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
Steve, I'm looking at this wonderful book, and one of the things I love about it so much are all of the different textures. That it could be possible to have such an erotic poem like The Latitudes of Desire, that is all one sentence over a page and a fourth, juxtaposed against a poem like Prayer for a Marriage, a very tender poem in three-line stanzas, that you could have poems like An Ode to Rosa Parks juxtaposed with a poem written to somebody who set a speaker's truck on fire. So the amazing textural, you know, and differences in the poems, the whimsy of the Jimmy Toombs poem.
Right.
I was wondering if we could talk about how such a book was put together, sustaining kind of the long work.
There is, I've noticed, a wider variety to the poems than I had originally thought, and I'm really glad about that. And I think that it partly came from the putting together of this book was interesting in that I had three separate manuscripts at one time, and I was invited to send a manuscript to LSU Press, and I sent the three manuscripts, and I was told by the editor, Dave Smith, that what I ought to do is make a single book of the three books. And at first, I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. And I actually wrote him a letter and said, you know, I'm sorry, but thank you very much for offering. And because what I needed was an editor. And for some reason, I expected him or them to be that. And I really resisted at first, you know, that kind of hard look that we have to take at our work, which is difficult to do emotionally because we love our poems, but it's also like difficult to do, I think, because it's hard to see. In particular, I think these three manuscripts had a different kind of sense to them, each of them, and they were too unified in that way, you know. And I think a book that has the kind of diversity that our lives have is more fascinating and in the end more interesting to us than, and this isn't you know, some kind of necessary truth, but books of unified themes are fascinating. But I wanted to make a book that reflected more of my poetic life over the past 10 years. You know, that so that you do have poems that are sometimes very different sitting next to each other. And I like the idea of like kind of two rocks banging together.
And putting together that manuscript, then you had to leave out some poems. I'm thinking specifically of a poem called The Kiss that you read at the Eric Schindler Gallery about a year and a half ago in Richmond. And a letter that you wrote to me about putting together a manuscript, and you wrote, even the poems you do not include play a part for you in the book. I'm wondering if you could talk about that, the poems that are not in the book and what they have to do with the book.
That's an excellent question, because that's something that I love to think about, are the poems, like in putting a book together, and especially now moving on to new work, you wonder, what are you going to end up including? But you can't think that way, really. You have to love each poem and make each poem work and happen and lead to the next one. You know, you can't really think that way, because it's not good, you know, unless you're making a book. And when I'm writing poems, I don't feel like I'm making a book necessarily, but when I was putting this together, there are those ghost poems. All those poems, you know, you write for 10 years and you write every day. That's a lot of work. And, you know, some has been thrown away and abandoned over the years, and some is just beloved. And some of those most beloved poems of mine I didn't include in the book. And that is interesting that, you know, I started to see a shape. And I think writers, poets in particular, when they put a collection together, you know, I think when you put a book together, you have a chance to make something that's larger than a mere collection. And so I was looking for unities. And so that meant I had to leave out some poems that may have said something another poem says, but maybe not in the way that the book needed, you know. So I was lucky to have options, that there were maybe three or four poems that were doing something similar that helped me decide what to keep and what to throw away.
That must have been a joy for Dave to receive that in the mail then after your letter.
It was a pain in the ass.
And then it happened. And speaking of absences and presences and ghost poems and the fullness of sort of the harvest that is there, the book was accepted for publication, but you still felt that there was one poem that wasn't written, and that was The Ode to Rosa Parks. So the book was accepted. That poem had not been written and wasn't in it yet. What's right. that story?
Well, that's interesting too, because during the editing process, I did a lot of, I think, improvement to many of the poems in here. And if you can see a proof copy of the book, it's very different than what is finished. But that poem in particular, I did start after the book was accepted, and it was something that I had been, Rosa Parks is someone who I had been thinking about, and thinking about Southern history in particular, I had been thinking, have been thinking about. And so this poem, just I started writing it, and it happened to be when the book had already been taken. But I did want to make a point of including one of these poems that was new, for one thing, brand new, which was a risk, because I finished that thing right at the last second that I could possibly work on it. And there is a typo in that poem, partly because of that. But it'll be fixed for the next printing. But I think this is something I said in the reading last night, is she is someone who I think stands for what is greatest in the South and what is greatest in our country, too. This kind of, I think, of courage, which is something I do tend to think a lot about, because I do think poets are called to it. And I think sometimes when we believe too much that poetry makes nothing happen, if you believe that, I think you risk a kind of cowardice as a writer, and especially as a poet. And I think you're missing the chance to say what you mean, or to think about what you mean, and consider it, and in some cases stand up for it, which I don't think we think about that much as poets in particular. We like to think about the delight and the freedoms and the possibility we have. Especially as Americans, I think, too, that there are certain things we take for granted. You know, everyone says, oh, poetry's ignored all the time and all this business. And maybe poetry has a different place in this country than it does maybe in some other more politically charged countries. But I do think there are poems that people write or could write that could bring conflict, could change their lives.
Yes.
And I think you have to risk those, too. And I think it's easy not to even think about that, and to write the comfortable poems of your life, which I don't think is enough sometimes. So in that light, I was thinking of people who do such a thing. And I was thinking about, frankly, the courage of the Southern soldier, too. All these boys who died, and they stood up in the face of certain death, and many survived, and most didn't, it seems. But I do think there is a tradition of that kind of standing up in the South. And I know it's hard sometimes to particularize what it is that makes a Southern poet a Southern poet. I'm really not sure what that is. But I do think there is something in the South, and it has to do with the great arguments that's going on right now about heritage and hate and all of that. But there's something that does seem to always be humming in this region that I think people like Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King understood.
And that leads me to this poem, Who Wants to Know What Love Is Worth? And at the very end of the poem, you're addressing John Keats, and the speaker says, yes, it is spring, John Keats, and you are dead, and I am sorry. Truth and beauty are not all I need to know. They never were, though important. I need something more. It hums and whirs. One of the things that I love about this book is in that hum and worrying, you have everything from a wife boiling pasta next mm-hmm. to prison guards. Mm-hmm. You have Robert Johnson. You have a woman at a 7-Eleven with a broom jumping out of her hands. This whole mix of the public and the personal, of the concrete and the imaginary, of the historical and the personal, seems to form that humming and worrying that make the poems poems of great truth and beauty, you know, what you take in with the poems. So I was wondering if we could talk about, in light of what is happening in the world right now, a year after the attacks in New York and at the Pentagon, and sort of a mood in the country, a fear of possible war. Last week I attended the Geraldine Ford Poetry Festival and heard such a sane and powerful conversation about what is happening and art in the midst of that. And one of the things that happened was that poets were asked to read one poem of their own, thinking of the theme, envisioning a new future. And so to hear poets like Stanley Kunitz, the amazing Kunitz, and Lucille Clifton, and Robert Bly, and Naomi Shihab Nye, and the Polish poet Adam Zagajewski read one of their own poems, and then another poem, many in translation. I was thinking the poem of yours that I would read, if asked, would be something new under the sun, the poem that starts the manuscript. I was wondering if, one, you would read that poem, two, talk about why you led the manuscript with it, and three, discuss this. At the time it was written, these events had not happened. Does a poem change in the context of what's happening in the culture around it? Will this poem now be read differently because of those events?
Well, thank you, yeah. I will read the poem. Something new under the sun. It would have to shine and burn and be a sign of something infinite and turn things and people nearby into their wilder selves and be dangerous to the ordinary nature of signs and glow like a tiny hole in space to which a god presses his eye and stares, or her eye. Some divine, impossible stretch of the imagination where you and I are one. It would have to be something Martin Buber would say, and seeing it, point and rejoice. It could be the mouth of a Coca-Cola bottle, or two snakes rolling down a mountain trail. It would have to leap up out of the darkness of a theater and sing the high, silky, operatic note of someone in love, and run naked, slender fingers through the hair of a stranger, or your mother or father or grandfather, or a grassy hill in West Virginia. It would live on berries and moss like a deer and roam the woods at night like the secret life of the woods at night. And when the sun rises, you could see it and think it is yours, and that would be enough. And it would come to you as these words have come to me, slowly, tenderly, tangibly, shy and meanderingly. Thank you for requesting that I read that poem, and I like to think about it too, because it's not a poem that I think enough about now, and I rarely ever read it, and I'm not sure why, though I'm glad to have the opportunity today to do both things. So I think that since 9/11, there has been a kind of quiet response by a lot of poets, and I think that seems wise. I guess all I should do is speak from my own experience as a reader and a writer afterwards, is that I find that it is the daily response that our poetry has to the world around us that is a comfort, I think, to so many people who rarely read poems in the first place, but who have been reading poems more since 9/11. I think that poetry is a kind of witness, and it has been one for a long time, to kind of, like you said, the truth and the beauty of our ordinary lives. And I think that we hunger for that kind of sensibility after 9/11. And I think as a poet, as a writer, I find that my process hasn't changed any. And as a reader, it hasn't changed either. But I do think that you're right, that there are poems that will be read differently because of that. And I think that there's, and in particular, in this book, there's a poem called Whoever Set My Truck on Fire. And I think about that poem often in the context of what happened, because it is a very violent poem. And I like that about it. And it is an unrepentantly vengeful poem. And it makes me a little uncomfortable, to tell you the truth, reading it sometimes. But I think that's part of the beauty of it. I think a poet should be made uncomfortable by his or her book sometimes, especially as you move away from it. But about this poem in particular, I like this poem, I think it's okay to admit it, I do like this poem for its quiet affirmation of the possible. You know, I like that it is, I thought, a nice way to begin a book, talking about just the way that these words have come to me, and they come slowly, tenderly, tangibly, shy and meanderingly, like something wild. But we never think of wild things like that, you know, but that is often the wild things I see. That's how they move. A possum, deer, you know, raccoon, You know, that's how things move around us out there. And it seems when I think of nature, when I think of the divine, and if I'm ever able to think about those things with any clarity, I think of those things the way I think about the wild.
I love that kind of what I would call radical power at the end of that poem. And I think it would be such an inspiration to writers to say, back up a couple of steps and start to name the details of your lives and see what happens from there, that kind of act of dailiness. That makes me think of something that you said when we had a conversation in your home just over a year ago. And we were talking about dailiness and the life of a poet and where the imagination comes into that. We were talking actually about the occasional poem. And I was wondering, you know, how do people ever do that? To be asked to write a poem for something? I just wasn't sure about that. And I loved your response at that time, and you may have changed your opinion since then, which we could talk about. And you said something like, well, you know, Leslie, every poem is an occasional poem. Every poem comes out of some kind of immediate urgency or invitation or need. And then you talked about it literally, that there were at least three poems in the book that were written for specific occasions. And we also used the word communal and community, that that could be part of the daily practical life of a poet. If you are asked to write a poem, you accept that invitation and do the best you can.
Right.
What do you think about that?
I think that's great. There is a daily and practical life of a poem, you know, and I think that is, since 9/11, I think that is partly what people are recognizing. And I love that about the response that so many people, especially Americans, have had to their poets and their poems. They've been embracing something that I think poets, I think, do. We do have duties. And no, we don't like to talk about it so much, or maybe use that word, but we do. And I think that we take care of things. We take care of those duties. We live up to certain responsibilities by writing the poems we need to write without setting up too many rules for ourselves. But speaking of occasional poems, poems where you do have a rule set up, like, well, I'm going to write a poem now about this, which is hard. But I love doing that, actually, and it helps me. I like to write all the time, and so having an occasion to write one is always a helpful invitation. But I do think that, I love how you put that about that kind of urgency, that every poem does have this immediate reason for being here. And even when it's done, when it's been sitting around for 10 years, I think that if it's a good poem, there's still that need for it to be around and a need for it to be written. And I love, as a writer, to look at the blank page that way and to think of what urgencies there are that I need to pay attention to. And when I think that way, there's really no writer's block. There's no stopping. There's no kind of silence that's crippling or anything like that. Because when I think about, you know, what's available to me and I think about opportunities, I do think every poem has an occasion. And I think about like the old poet laureates of Britain who wrote poems for state occasions. And I think about an American poet writing, our occasions are often, you know, I wrote some for birthday present for my mother. You know, and I think about the state occasion of my family. You know, here, you know, I'm the poet laureate of my family, that's for sure. And I take actually a great amount of joy in writing poems for people. And I think some, you know, maybe some people don't like that so much, but that's not really true. I think people do like to get a poem and to know, too, that their lives or the specific particulars of their life or their day can become a part of a poem so easily, too. It is a wonderful kind of communication, and it's a surprising one.